Baltazar, Sharia has been in the news these past few months. States like Oklahoma have tried to pass bans banning Sharia. But the truth is, most people actually do not know what Sharia is. We hear the word, but we don't know what it means. Can you just say, what's the most important thing you think people should know about Sharia? Can you tell us what it is and then what it is not?
Sure. In a nutshell, Sharia is the ideal law of God according to Islam. And it is not an Islamic law as fiqh or as the human attempt to know what is in the mind of God. And so Muslims believe that the Islamic legal system is one that appeals to or aims toward ideals of justice, fairness, and the good life. And there are numerous ways of trying to figure out what that is. So as far as what Sharia is, what it is not, some of the things I mentioned, it's an ideal system of law. It has tremendous diversity as people try to, as jurists, learned scholars, try to figure out and articulate what that law is. And historically, it served as a means for political dissent against arbitrariness or arbitrary rule. So it's not a monolithic doctrine of violence, as has been characterized in the recent Tennessee bill to criminalize practices of Sharia, particularly not against America or any particular country.
So the misinformation that Sharia is this monolithic law that's going to come and rule America, you're saying that's a misconception. And what's wrong about that? What are the inaccuracies in that message right there?
Well, the inaccuracies are in the message itself, to presume that Sharia is a monolithic set of laws. It's not. It's an attempt to figure out what the best set of laws are for Muslim societies. Another thing that's wrong with that statement is that sort of transposes what Sharia was historically for Muslim societies to in a modern American context. But here, everything changes, where Sharia is not the law of the state, and nor do most of the 1.3 billion Muslims in the world understand for it to be or purport it to be. So it's becomes a privatized system of religious precepts by which Muslims live, insofar as it doesn't conflict with the laws of the United States.
If someone didn't know what Sharia was, if someone were Christian and Jewish, and you were trying to help people understand, is there an equivalent? Could you say, well, it's like this in Christianity, or it's like this in Judaism? Are there similarities?
Sure. That's actually a really good comparison, or set of comparisons, because Sharia is, historically, it was a broad system that encompassed ritual law, so instructions for how to worship, as well as society's law, so how to form a contract and that sort of thing. So in that sense, in the ritual sense, it's like a lot like Jewish law that has a rule for how to pray, how to make ablution before prayers, how to eat and that sort of thing. So these very minute details are there in the ritual aspects of Sharia or Islamic law. But then there are also broader principles that Sharia tried to embody: justice, fairness. And that is a lot like Christianity's more broad sweeping emphasis on love, or overall overarching doctrines that the religion itself tries to promote. And then in the public sphere, whenever Sharia was part of a system that ruled according to the the character of the majority of the people, which was at the time mostly Muslim, then it was also state law, as it is in some Middle Eastern countries today, and as it is not in, in a lot of Middle Eastern countries as well, who have opted to not have Sharia be state law.
So let's go to other countries in a minute, but for right now, to stick with America. So Americans were Christians, they might practice their faith by tithing, giving money to charity or to their church. They might pray before meals or after meals. They might observe certain religious holidays, or maybe not shop on Sunday, depending on what their religious beliefs were. And similarly for people who are Jewish. But that doesn't mean but they would still obey local laws, federal laws, and the Constitution. So if Muslim Americans are living in this country, wherever that might be, how might they practice their faith in a way that somebody might say, this is evidence or this is an illustration of Sharia? Is there an example that you could give us?
Sure, and those are great examples because they're parallel, that you gave, they're parallels to what happens for Muslims in the practice of Sharia in daily life in America. So there are certain tenets of Islam that require Muslims who choose to adhere to it in America to give charity, to pray, to attend the mosque, to fast during the month of Ramadan. So these are some examples of how Muslims would fulfill religious obligations. And then there are social obligations as well. And I like to point to an organization in Chicago, the Inner City Muslim Action Network, which itself says that it is inspired by Islam precepts to give back to the local community, or to make sure that the poor and the needy and the disenfranchised in one's community are taken care of. And so that's actually an example of the practice of Sharia in America. And a final example I point to are areas where Muslims are concerned with their own private affairs, so marriage laws and that sort of thing. Much like Christians mm-hmm. have marriages or weddings in a church, Muslims often have weddings in a mosque or some other venue presided over by an imam, and it's solemnized by the state as well. So there's a religious aspect to a wedding ceremony as well as a state aspect to a wedding ceremony.
Right. So for critics who say, well, Sharia is a threat to democracy, and that's why we need these public laws against it, because it would just take over American law, what can you say about that? Is Sharia a threat to, I mean, clearly it isn't from our conversation, but just how would you respond to that? And then just how would you discuss how religious codes, which many people have, and then the U.S. legal system, how do they live side by side?
Right. So as you know, I have studied and I teach both American law and Islamic law in an American law school. And so I'm very much attuned to seeing issues of religion in terms of American federal and state laws. And so I think for critics to say that Sharia is a threat to our system or to democracy have an impoverished understanding of what our laws are and what they accommodate and limit. So we have the very First Amendment of the Constitution that affirms free exercise or free practice of religion at the same time not establishing religion of any kind. And so this twin clause of free exercise but non-establishment allows a wide array of religious practice in America, Islam being one of them, which has been a part of the fabric of American religious and civic life from the founding, from the civil rights movement, and even before the founding, with Muslims arriving as slaves, with Muslims being prominent citizens in the 1900s and in the last century. So we've never had a threat to our democracy from the long time practice of Muslims in America. And I think that stems in part from the nature of Muslim religious practice in America, which seeks to, it's a more of a private religious matter for most Muslims than any public, than any system having a very public iteration. And it also speaks to the strength and flexibility of our laws, both state and federal, that continuously affirm religion as a value that we want to encourage free practice of, but also not establish in any government or public sense.
So what you just said was interesting on a lot of levels. You said that Muslim Americans have been in this country for hundreds of years, and that's true. And so people who've been practicing their faith, which includes Sharia, has been going on for a really long time. So this is not a new thing. This is just part of people's lives. This is part of people's religious practices. Why do you think it's getting attention now if this is not a new thing?
Well, in a word, I'd say politics. Leading up to the midterm elections in November 2010, we saw a lot of talk about the mosque controversy in New York and the specter of Muslim Americans taking over. That was the first time that we saw a bill in Oklahoma against the citation of Sharia law. The Tennessee bill goes a lot farther than that. And in my view, a lot of it had to do with the politics of equating Sharia with Muslims, with terrorism, with national security, as an attempt from some, especially on the right, like Newt Gingrich, to rally support around some wedge issue that would incite the base and get them excited about something on the right's agenda. So I simply think it's politics that has made it come up, and it's at a time where it can strike some sensitive chords, because in fact we have had horrible, tragic events happen to us as a country, with the events of 9/11, with the wars in the Middle East that sort of raised the specter of Islam as a negative phenomenon. And I think that playing on those fears is a card that's now being used 10 years after the fact.
I want to talk about other countries in a minute, but I just want to go to Tennessee, because you mentioned the law that was introduced in Tennessee. And tell me if I'm right about my understanding of it. My understanding is that it goes further than the Oklahoma ban, and that in Tennessee it would be a felony to practice Sharia, which, if that includes your faith, means it would be a felony to pray, a felony to give money to charity, a felony to fast. Is that correct? And if it is, would it be a felony for everybody to pray? Or is it singling out Muslims and say Christians and Jews can pray and give money to charity, but Muslims cannot? How does the law go?
Yeah, so according to the draft text that I've seen of the Tennessee bill that's been published in the Washington Times and elsewhere, it would be a felony to perform everyday practices like praying, like giving to charity, like fasting, because that would be defined as a banned Sharia practice. And for that to be in the bill is clearly unconstitutional. wouldn't survive in a courtroom, both because it violates the religious free exercise clauses, again, of the First Amendment, and because it's a violation of equal protection laws, in fact, singling out Muslim religious practice as banned, but allowing Christian religious practice or Jewish religious practice or Buddhist religious practice. And that is always impermissible, particularly when it doesn't conflict with any state public policy. There may be times when we as a state want to limit some aspects of the private practice of Islamic law. For example, when a California court ruled that allowing women to take a certain sum of money upon divorce, as is typical in Islamic marriage contracts, was against the California state public policy of profiteering from divorce. Other courts have found differently on that issue. But that is to say that there may be times when the issue arises as to whether Islamic legal practices conflict with public policy, and courts will then resolve them, and they will be adhered to, as they were in the California case. But to issue a blanket ban on otherwise lawful and wholly permissible and civically valuable religious practice is what the Tennessee law proposes and is unconstitutional.
Do laws, courts adjudicate, you gave the example of California and divorce, between other faiths too, where a religious practice in terms of divorce might bump into civil courts and they might have to adjudicate this in Christianity or Judaism?
Yes, and so law courts, whenever they're presented with an issue, whether it comes from a religious contract or some secular private contract, and it gets to the courts because it's an issue that seems to raise matters that conflict with public policy, then yes, law courts adjudicate issues that come from different religions, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, other religions. And so to that extent, it is seeking to make sure that state policy is, in fact, the supreme law of the land, as the law is already set forth and is non-discriminatory and applying to all faiths. Typically, Jewish communities in particular, and some Muslim communities as well, have, these such matters as marriage and divorce sort of proceed informally. It's only in the rare instance when there is an issue that requires the state to get involved does the matter go to the court in the way that I mentioned before. And American judges will adjudicate the matter with reference to American law. So there is no threat of Sharia law or any other religious law superseding the law of the state.
Let's talk for a minute about Sharia and other countries. Critics of Sharia talk about the creeping threat that it's as if it's a monolithic system, punitive system in other countries, and it's going to come and take over the United States. Can you talk? You just a minute ago said that some Muslim majority countries adopt Sharia, some do not. Can you just talk about that a little bit? What the diversity is, and in other countries?
Sure. Of some 150 countries that are part of the Organization of Islamic Countries, or Organization of Islamic Conference, 26 of them make Islamic law a source or the source of law according to the Constitution. But of that number, all but five apply that only to matters of family law and inheritance law. So the number of countries where Sharia is the law of the land is extremely narrow. If we were to really quantify it, it's two. Saudi Arabia and Iran apply Islamic law most extensively. But amongst the other countries where there are Muslim majority countries, we have countries like Turkey, where which follows a French model of secularism, where religion is not permitted to appear at all in the public sphere. We have countries like Senegal, which has a Muslim majority, but doesn't have any particular legal status for Islamic law. And then there are countries like Egypt, which has Islamic law as a part of its constitution, as a source of law. And we've seen in the past 3 decades since that clause was inserted in the constitution that Egypt did not turn into an authoritarian Islamic law state. It was an authoritarian state, but not on the basis of Islamic law. Incidentally, that clause remains with the revisions to the proposed amendments to the constitution. And the Supreme Constitutional Court of Egypt has managed to work out definitions of Islamic law that come from secular judges on that court, and they don't allow the religious clerics who are not part of the state system to define what the state law is, even when it relates to Islamic law.
So can you talk for a minute about who actually gets to interpret Sharia, and if there are disputes, certainly in other religions, in Judaism and Christianity, there's many denominations and many different faith traditions, depending on people, how people interpret the Bible and teachings. And there's lots of heated discussions about those disputes and those differences. Does that exist within Sharia as well?
Absolutely, that exists, and that's the $64,000 question of the day. Who gets to speak for Sharia? And traditionally, it was this class of educated jurists or scholars who spent a lifetime studying legal texts and theory and practice. So they were much like the jurisconsults of ancient Rome or the law professors in modern America, who got to, imagine if the law professors got to say what the law is. That's the equivalent of what the classical or traditional Muslim society was like, and who got to speak for Islamic law. It wasn't the judges or the executives. But now, and even then, there was a wide diversity of opinion as to what that was. So if you have, there's an old joke that if you put 4 law professors in a room and ask them about a single question, you'll get at least 5 answers. So it was a lot like that. And we had, there were 4 major Sunni schools, 3 major Shi'i schools, even in the pre-modern period. Now in the modern period, there is even more diversity of opinion, as not only these scholars are saying that they have the authority to say what Sharia is or to interpret Sharia, but other individuals are also saying that they have the right to say what Sharia is. And so, we have some scholarly informed interpretations of what Sharia is. It is based on considerable research, again, likening it to law professors. And then we have sort of popular Islamic legal opinions, and that would apply to many in the Middle East and perhaps beyond. Middle East who decide that they can interpret what Sharia is. And then we have others who intentionally distort Sharia to serve their political ambitions. And for this latter category, I think this applies to the likes of bin Laden in the Muslim context and Newt Gingrich in the American context. And these people are clearly at the margins of the conversation. I mean, so again, it's out of 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, we hear of a handful of folks following interpretations like the one that bin Laden espouses. And it's newsworthy precisely because it's rare.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that Sharia, it's not monolithic, it's not frozen in time, that in fact it's dynamic, it's changing, it's open to interpretation. It's got popular self-appointed experts, it's got legal scholars, religious scholars, all of whom are having their say in terms of what they think it is, and we're really talking about the religious aspects of someone's life. Does that sound like what you're saying?
Yes, I think that's a great characterization. It's popular, it's diverse. There are many who speak for Sharia or interpret it, and it does have to do with how people are interpreting religion in their lives, whether in a personal sense or with respect to the community or some overarching authority. There is no church akin to the Catholic Church in Islam, no pope. And so with so little hierarchy, you get a very diffuse Protestant-like sort of view of what Islamic law means in the religious lives of individual Muslims and communities of Muslims.
So what you're talking about doesn't sound at all like what public misperceptions are based on the headlines we read, what we see on TV, what pundits say, and what's in these proposed laws. So there's a great deal of lack of information and misinformation regarding Sharia in this country. What do you think the effects of that are?
I think the effects are largely negative with some small glimmer of positive. I think that the misinformation regarding Sharia results in a fear-mongering that, again, is used for political ends and so may bring about legislative victories from the ones in Oklahoma or Tennessee to larger legislative victories. In larger elections, it can and has resulted in profiling against ordinary Americans who are Muslim. It results in something of particular concern to me, fomenting ignorance and misinformation in a way that is not helpful to a conversation where we can become more informed about what this large, diverse, 1,400-year-old tradition means in its varied forms and what possibilities it has. And also a particular concern, it may have a chilling effect on civic engagement of lawful activities by Muslims like giving and charity, like praying and carrying out their ordinary lives in ways that are definitely of no harm or threat to the public, but restrict the free exercise and civic engagement of individual Muslims. The glimmer of positive that I see is that perhaps all of the negative press creates some sort of interest or spark some sort of conversation, which of course I'm all in favor of, discourse, not just with those I agree with, but so maybe the dissent sparks some interest in knowing or getting educated about, well, what is the specter of Sharia? What is Sharia creep and what's behind it? And so to the extent that the misinformation or the fear that's put out there about Sharia encourages dialogue and discussion and public education, then I think there can be positive outcomes if we continue to learn and sort of seek to educate ourselves about what Sharia is and what it is not.
I just have one last question for you. So let's say someone's reading this interview and they don't really know very much about Sharia at all, other than what they've heard, and are thinking, well, boy, maybe all of those things aren't true, and would like just, you know, a quick sentence, something they can remember in their regular conversations with neighbors, coworkers, and friends who may say, oh, creeping Sharia is coming, I think passing this law is a good idea. So if you could just say to people just one thing to remember about Sharia and to be able to say about it, what would that one thing be?
So if I were to try to boil it down,
I know that's hard.
Yeah, I mean, I might say, you know, you can say, well, actually, Sharia is the Arabic name for Islamic law, which is an extremely diverse doctrine that Muslims believe represent ideals of justice, fairness, and the good life that Americans hold dear. And it's worth learning more about what that means from informed sources before judging it to be a monolithic negative entity.
That's terrific. And actually, your answer made me ask one more quick last question. To actually translate the word. So if there's an equivalent of Sharia, it also means, and then fill in the blank.
So it literally means the way and the sort of full meaning of that is the way to justice or the way to justice that is willed by God, and the attempt to find the way is an enduring attempt that humans of all ages will continue to have to struggle to best realize the best ideals of justice. It's a work in progress, not a finished product.
That's perfect. Thank you so much, Intisar, for talking with us, and all best wishes to you and your work.
Thank you.